We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. Harriet Williamson is our producer. Jason Croft is at the controls this morning. The Churchills are an extraordinary family. Now, the member who looms the largest in the popular imagination, of course, is Winston Churchill. But the family's roots go back all the way to the 1600s and a man named John Churchill, who was the first Duke of Marlborough. This is a family that fought battles. They built a palace. They were involved at high levels in British politics and have been constantly connected with everyone who mattered in British society. In this hour of our show, we'll explore some of this history with Mary Lovell, who is the author of a newly published book, The Churchills in Love and War. It's published by W.W. Norton. She's the author of best-selling biographies Straight On Till Morning, that's a biography of Beryl Markham, and also The Sisters, which is about the Mitford family. Her home is in England. She's now spending a little bit of time in the United States to talk about the Churchills, and we're pleased to have her with us as a guest this morning on the show. Questions are welcome, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that is good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. And if you would like to send in a question by email, you may do that. Write to will-talk@illinois.edu. Ms. Lovell, hello.
Oh, hello, David.
Thank you very much for talking with us. We appreciate it.
My pleasure.
This is a truly fascinating and remarkable family. Two major figures here, one that people will know, Winston Churchill, and one going back several hundred years. We'll talk about John Churchill and maybe a few scoundrels and no accounts in between. But I think that if you talk about the importance of this family in Britain, all of the people that they knew, all of the people they connected with, their involvement in politics, I'm thinking, do we have anybody in the United States to compare them to give people something to grab onto, just as a way of understanding the Churchills? I'm not sure that we do.
Well, I guess it would be the Kennedys.
That was my thought. The only bunch that I can think of that would be anything like the Churchills.
Mm.
And I'm not even sure that there you have a figure that is as highly thought of to this very day as Winston.
I mean, not even JFK?
I'm not sure that he would be. Certainly, I'm sure that there were a lot of people that did and still do revere him. But in terms of the numbers Americans, well, I'm just thinking about how, you know, the consistent result when you go around and you ask people in Britain, well, who do you think was the most admired Briton ever? And hands down, it's always Winston Churchill.
Correct.
And I'm not sure that you would get that same kind of reading about John Kennedy or Franklin Roosevelt or anybody like that here in this country. Now, I could be wrong. I'm not sure quite that there's anybody to match Winston.
Abe Lincoln?
Perhaps.
So
if you go all the way back into early American history, yes. Well, Mr. Washington, Mr. Lincoln, somebody, a figure of the 20th century. I'm not really sure that there's anybody to match Winston.
No, perhaps not.
Yeah, the beginnings of the family, or at least its being a force, do start with this man named John Churchill, who was the first Duke of Marlborough. He was born in 1650. And was, by all accounts, quite a remarkable man on the battlefield.
Well, he was a brilliant military tactician. He won every campaign he ever fought. But his finest hour came really towards the end of his professional life, when his victories against Louis XIV in the War of the Spanish Succession culminated in a magnificent victory at Blenheim, and that made Europe safe from war for a whole century until Napoleon came on the scene. Mm. He was never, ever defeated, and his record as a commander has never been equaled, not even by the great Duke of Wellington. And a grateful nation, and Queen Anne, gave him a palace as a reward, and he called it Blenheim.
And this is a truly, I only know it from having seen photographs of this place, but certainly I would suggest at some point people go onto the web, open up their computers, and just put it in. It's spelled Blenheim, Blenheim, that's the way that they pronounce it there. And take a look at this place, a more enormous pile of stone I'm sure I have never seen.
7 acres under the roof. Can you believe that?
It's just an enormous place, and I guess that really was the point.
George III, who I think is quite well known here in America, King George III went there with his wife. The first time he saw it, he said to his wife, "We have nothing to touch this."
The idea was that it was supposed to be an award for the great service that the Duke had rendered. But it's interesting that then, I think ever after, it became a real burden for the family because it didn't come with a lot of land, and that was the way you maintain your property, with the revenues from your land. And so it seems that they were always, we would say that they're house poor and always were house poor.
Yes, you've got it in one there. I mean, for some reason, John Churchill, when he became first Duke, he decided he wanted an English Versailles, and that's what he built. His wife, Sarah, hated it. I mean, she helped because she adored John. She wanted him to have what he wanted, so she argued and fought and got this amazing building built, but she loathed it. I mean, it's not a comfortable place at all. If you go there, you look around, you think, God, I wouldn't want to live here. You know, it's okay to go for the day with the family, but it's not a comfortable house at all. I don't think. But you're quite right. It has proved a white elephant, really, to successive generations. Although it defines them, it's their, you know, the place that they identify with. I mean, it's just beggared people for generations, really.
Yeah.
Still doing so, I think. And, you know, you have to marry a rich wife if you're the Duke of Marlborough. You can't just marry, you know, someone you meet and fall in love with. You've got to marry money.
Yeah. And two of them did, and were not, probably nobody was really all that happy about it. That's, again, one of the big stories, I think, that you see in this family.
Well, more than two, but the one I think you're probably referring to is Sonny, the ninth Duke, who married poor little Consuelo Vanderbilt, one of the greatest heiresses in the world at the time. But, I mean, she was literally forced to the altar, went down the aisle, weeping behind her veil. She was 19. She was in love with someone else, forced to marry this man. He was only 21, and he was in love with someone else. But he felt his duty was to marry money. So he married Consuelo, and her mother forced her into this marriage. In fact, her mother had educated Consuelo to be a fit consort for European nobility, if not royalty. And so Consuelo was married. I mean, it was dreadful, really. She really was sold, you know, into marriage. And it was a deeply unhappy marriage. She quickly produced two sons, thank God, very quickly, which she called the heir and the spare. And then that marriage became, you know, they lived separate lives within the marriage. And he, the Duke, then took as his lover Consuelo's best friend, who was another American girl called Gladys Deacon. Later they were able to divorce, and he and the Duke married Gladys. That was a deeply unhappy marriage. She decided at one point that she had, after three miscarriages, she was not going to have any more pregnancies. So, and as the Duke had just become a Catholic, and they, of course they couldn't use any form of contraception, she took to toting a gun around and having it on her bedside table at night.
In case you wanted to
nocturnal visits, yes.
To come in and visit. That's one of just a countless remarkable stories. You think, oh, if you wrote that in a novel, people might think that it was over the top. That she was packing heat, as we would say, just to make sure that she would the Duke wouldn't bother her.
Yeah, amazing.
This is really one of the truly sad stories, and that is the story of Consuelo and Sonny. But this was the kind of a marriage that it was a prime example of a marriage that was fairly common at that time between landed gentry on that side of the ocean who needed money and wealthy American families who were interested in enhancing their social status by picking up a title.
That's right. I think actually, Blenheim really belongs more to the Americans than it does to the British. Because certainly since the middle of the 19th century, it has been upkept by American money. It would be a complete wreck by now if it hadn't been for that. Even the fact that, they take in millions every year as a tourist attraction. they still need, on top of that, they still need an awful lot of money to upkeep that. I mean, can you believe, you know, 7 acres under a roof? It's a vast building. Yeah. Ridiculous thing, yeah. Really.
And I guess a lot of Consuelo's money went into refurbishing.
Oh, even after their divorce. They divorced at the end of the First World War, and she married a Frenchman, lived happily ever after. But the marriage settlement was Sonny's anyway. And so, of course, he went on using Consuelo's money, and I think it, down the generations, because of course it was left in perpetuity, you know, to the heirs, her son with Sonny, the ninth Duke, you know, he was still using Vanderbilt money into this century.
Hmm. Our guest in this hour, Mary Lovell, we're talking about the Churchill family, the subject of her new book, The Churchills in Love and War, and questions are welcome, 333-9455, a toll-free 800-222-9455. There were a lot of remarkable women that married into this family, and I know we're sort of jumping around, but I do want to go back and give you the opportunity to talk a little bit about Sarah Jennings, who was the wife of John Churchill, the first Duke. She was somebody who was certainly herself very well connected, was very ambitious, and one would wonder how much of his success was in fact due to her.
Well, he saw her first when she was 16. She was a lady-in-waiting to the young Princess Anne. She was penniless, but you know, she was well connected, as you say. And John first saw, he was 24, he was on leave. He had been serving abroad. He came back to court, and he saw her dancing a dance called a saraband, at a court dance, a court ball. He fell madly in love with her. And she was 16 years old, you know. And he really needed to marry money because he was trying to make his way in the world. But once he'd seen Sarah, there was no hope for it. Now, Sarah was a very forceful, ambitious, tempestuous woman. She wasn't what you'd call a beauty. She was handsome, I suppose. And she was so ambitious that she had groomed Princess Anne to look to her for advice on everything, clothes, jewels, everything. Now, when Princess Anne came to the throne as Queen Anne, it was said that although Queen Anne reigned, it was Sarah Churchill who ruled. After they met and John fell in love with her, Sarah kept him at arm's length for almost 2 years till he was absolutely mad with lust for her. Eventually, she capitulated. They married against his parents' wishes. And in fact, they were so broke they had to go and live with the parents. They had no money even to buy a house when they first started off. But it was a long and a very happy marriage. And one of the nice stories that I like, after they'd been married for many years, 30 years, he'd been away on a tour of duty for about 5 months. And when he came back, he was so pleased to see her that he pleasured her without removing his boots.
I say.
I know, sorry. Is this a family show?
the Churchill men seem to have this facility for falling in love at the drop of a hat with stunning women, to be sure, and not always, you know, these things don't always last, but it seems that there's story after story of a man just as soon as he clapped eyes on some woman, he said, all right, that's it.
That's it. No, you're right. It was the Duke John did it, John Churchill. Then Lord Randolph, when he saw Jenny Jerome, that's Winston Churchill's parents, he did exactly the same thing. He decided on the day he first met her he was going to marry her. You know, there are countless. Randolph Churchill, that's Winston's son. Even Winston, you know, he'd only known Clementine a very short time when he decided he was going to marry her. They just have this, I don't know quite what to call it, an ability or a curse, really. You know, that they meet a woman, they fall madly in love. Quite often, it didn't last, but in Winston and Clementine's case, certainly it was a 50-year-old romance. And the same with John and Sarah, you know, the first Duke. I mean, their relationship only ended with Duke John's death, and she never remarried.
We have someone to bring into the conversation. Let's do that, someone who is in Champaign and on line number one right here. Hello.
Hello.
Hello there.
Yes.
All of the stuff about the Churchills and women is kind of cute. But what is the relationship between any and all of the Churchills regarding the assuming of power over the subcontinent of India, the enforcement of the opium trade with China, and with the roads as they destroyed the Dutch community in South Africa?
Well, you know, this my book is not, it's not a history book. I said this right at the start of my book. This is not a political or a history book. I could have easily, you know, if that had been my brief, I would have tackled those issues. But I didn't tackle those issues. This is literally a family saga. And I don't go into those issues. I mean, there's recently been an extremely good book.
I understand that at Churchill's death, he was quite unhappy with having nothing to do. Is this a truism?
He was quite. When are we talking about?
Winston Churchill, when as he was dying, that he was quite unhappy with having nothing more to do.
Well, I think when he was dying, he was a very old man, and he had a number of strokes and heart condition, and he was in a coma really for almost 2 weeks before he died. So, I don't know that is true, except that he did say to, I think it was Aristotle Onassis, that he hated being old and not being part of things. But, I think he was so old by then. I think he was just ready to die, really,
Mm.
In fact, he almost certainly chose the day of his own death because he died on exactly the same date as his father died, January the 24th. His father died in 1894. And about a couple of years before he died, Churchill said to his secretary, "My father died on January the 24th, and I shall die on January the 24th. And although he was in a coma for, as I say, 10 or 14 days before he died, he actually died on January the 24th within an hour and a half of the time of his father's death. So it's almost like as if subconsciously he kept himself alive to die on that date.
Well, other questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Our guest, Mary Lovell, is author of a new book. It's a family history of the Churchills, and it's called The Churchills in Love and War, and it's recently out from W.W. Norton. We talked a little bit about John and Sarah, the first Churchills. He was the first Duke of Marlborough. And then there's a period of maybe a couple of hundred years where the family continues and there continue to be a succession of dukes. But really, things don't, I think, get all that interesting until we come to maybe the time of the seventh Duke. This was the man who was Winston's father, Lord Randolph. The seventh Duke was his father. I'm having a hard time keeping all this straight. And because he was a third son, he was not in the line to be a duke. So the Duke was Winston's uncle.
Correct.
You could talk a little bit. There is a figure here that I'm interested in having you talk a little bit about, and that is Fanny, Randolph's
Fanny.
Mother, Winston's grandmother.
Yes, Duchess Fanny. Well, rather shy in company, I'm told, but a martinet with her servants and with her family. And it was Jenny Jerome who said that at the sound of Fanny's silken petticoats rustling, the whole house quaked. That, I think you do get women like that who can, be very rough with people at home, but they go into company and, they don't have much to say for themselves.
Mm.
But I don't think she was a fascinating person, Duchess Fanny, although she was later on when her son, who was the eighth Duke, when he died, and Sonny, the ninth Duke, came to the title, it was Duchess Fanny, his grandmother, who insisted that he marry for money, because otherwise, without that, Blenheim would not have survived. They needed that money.
And again, that's where poor Consuelo Vanderbilt comes into the picture.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I just feel when I was doing that particular part of the research, it really sort of got me in the heart, because I have a granddaughter now at the age that Consuelo was then, 18, going on 19. And Consuelo had been really strictly brought up. She had fallen in love with a young man in where they lived in, I think it's Long Island. And, he was in every way a suitable husband for her, but he didn't have a title. And you can imagine she went to this wedding, crying. And then, on their wedding night, she said in her memoir, which was called All That Glitters, there are such sorrows on that night that I can't bear to look at them, And it was her niece, Diana Guest, who I knew very well, who told me that. And really, it was almost legalized rape that wedding night. And she had said to him, "Look, I'm in love you know, you must know I've been forced into this marriage and I'm in love with someone else. And he said, well, so am I, you know, but we've got a duty. We have to make the next link in the chain. And, you know, I just found that so upsetting, really, to write about.
That's I guess that's really one of the sad things about the nobility, that it has to perpetuate itself at all costs,
yes.
And that the most important thing is to produce an heir,
yes.
To keep the line going, and other personal considerations just don't seem to count for very much.
Well, I don't know that the title certainly wouldn't go on if there was no one to inherit. But, of course, there was someone to inherit, but it wasn't in a direct line. If Consuelo had had no children, Winston would have been the next Duke, because Winston's father was the younger brother of the eighth Duke, you see. But he married Jenny Jerome. Again, another Churchill falling in love at first sight. Do you want me to tell you about that?
This is, here again, just so people can keep all the players straight here. This is Randolph Churchill, Winston's father. As you say, he was not the first son, so he was never, unless something happened to his brother, I guess, he would never be the Duke. But he was the father of Winston. And again, he, as you say, he was another one of these men who just he saw this woman and thought, well, that's that. Another maybe not as wealthy as Consuelo, but a wealthy American girl, Jenny Jerome.
Yes, she was an heiress, but not an heiress in Consuelo's league. And her father had made and lost, I think, three fortunes in the United States. At one time, I think he owned a 25% stake in the New York Times, and he was in Europe having a, you know, holiday vacation with his wife, and his partner back home sort of made a wrong decision. And so the thing that he most hated in his entire life was losing that 25% stake in the New York Times. But yes, he was able to give Jenny an annual income for her life that, you know, made her suitable to marry Lord Randolph, the son of a duke. And but even so, both parents were opposed to this. But Randolph was in Cowes Week. He'd gone to Cowes Week as part of the English social scene, went to a ball, saw her dancing, just like Duke John. He saw Jenny. Now, I have to tell you about Jenny. This is, she had flashing black eyes, very dark hair. Almost certainly she had some American Indian DNA. Her grandmother, I think, was one-eighth American Indian. And she was just so different from the English debutantes who were, you know, fair hair and blue-eyed. And this girl absolutely sparkled. He was absolutely mesmerized by her. That night, that evening after that ball, Mrs. Jerome, Jenny's mother, invited him back to dinner. And he told his aide who was with him, I'm going to marry the younger one, you know, which was Jenny. Her sister was Clarita. And Jenny, too, had been very well educated. She spoke fluent French and English, some Italian. She played the piano to concert standard. You know, she was a stunning woman, and I'm not surprised he fell in love with her. But both parents objected. The Duke felt that he didn't want his son marrying an American. He wanted her to marry an English girl. And Mr. Jerome thought, well, you know, perhaps they won't think my girl's good enough for them. And he wasn't really that keen. But anyway, they did get married. And 7 months later, Winston was born. Prematurely, it was said, but he was supposed to be a healthy baby. Now, in those days, you didn't say a child was healthy and premature. So I think they, in fact, got pregnant to force the parents' hands. That's my belief. I don't say that in the book, but that's actually just a little aside, just between you and I, actually, David.
Yes, you and I and the thousands of people who are listening.
I hope.
And I did wonder, these two women in particular, Jenny and Consuelo, how it is that the elite of Britain felt about these two American women and whether they were accepted or not.
I think they did. I mean, they might have sort of held their breath to see how they behaved. Do you know? Because that class of people can be extremely reserved about inviting people in. But you know, when Jenny knew absolutely everybody. I mean, she had the Prince of Wales as one of her lovers. You know, and Consuelo worked. She was very earnest, Consuelo. She worked terribly hard. I think they moved in the absolute top echelon of society, very well received, but they were both personable women. I don't know what would have happened if you'd been a country mouse and had married into that position. I mean, you would have really, I think, died the death of a thousand cuts, probably. Mm.
And Jenny, she was the one, they were married, they had two children, Winston and he had a brother.
And then
after that, although they continued to stay married for some time, they definitely lived separate lives. This was the woman, Jenny, who was said to have had 200 lovers.
Yes, I know, David, but I did a bit of research, and I could only find two dozen. Now, you might think that's enough for any woman anyway.
24. Yeah, it should be.
But it wasn't, it wasn't 200, no. Yeah.
But see, it's kind of a sad story about Randolph, was that he had syphilis.
Yes.
He died as a result. He had been Chancellor of the Exchequer, I guess that's the equivalent of the Secretary of the Treasury, I suppose.
That's correct, yes.
And that a lot of people thought that perhaps if he had been healthy and had lived, he might well have become Prime Minister.
Oh, it was en fait accompli. He was a Prime Minister in waiting. He was the best orator. And you remember, we're comparing him with people like Disraeli and Salisbury and Gladstone, you know. No, he was the best orator in the House of Commons at the time. And then he, you know, unfortunately contracted syphilis. Now, this is the days before antibiotics. And, of course, the first thing that happened when you were diagnosed with syphilis in those days was, the advice was, you know, you mustn't sleep with your wife. Well, hopefully they wouldn't sleep with anyone. But so the first Jenny knew about this was when she wrote to her sister and said, Randolph has removed himself from my bed. And she was puzzled because, you know, they were still in love. I mean, you can tell that from the letters. But he was spending a lot of time she was in Ireland at the time living with his parents. They were viceroy and vicereine of Ireland. And Randolph had gone back to England to make his way in Parliament. So suddenly Jenny found that she had no husband in that respect. Now, you know, she was young, she was passionate, and she had her own needs. So I'm not surprised that she took lovers, because I don't think they ever, after that, ever slept together. But they did stay together and live together within a marriage. But he died, he wasn't very old. I think he was about 44 when he decided, he was already diagnosed as being in the tertiary stage. He looked awful. He looked as if he was in his late 60s. And I show a photograph of him at that stage in my talk. But he then decided they must have a fact-finding tour of the world. He didn't believe that he was going to die. His doctor said, you'll never get back from this tour alive. They took with them a doctor, and they took a lead-lined coffin, just in case. And they made the tour, and he just made it home alive, and he died a few weeks later, as you know, on January the 24th.
Just a remarkable story. Our guest this morning is Mary Lovell. We're talking about the Churchill family and her book, The Churchills in Love and War, and we will talk some more after a short break. This is Focus.
The bike rodeo is coming to town. So round up your kids and bike them on down to the Urbana Market at the Square, Saturday, May 21st at 9 a.m. You and your kids will practice basic bike safety skills. Helmets are just $10 while they last. This free family event is brought to you by CU Safe Routes to Schools, CUMTD, and Illinois Public Media. For more information, visit wheelconnect.org/events.
This is Focus. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you with us. A quick mention that tomorrow morning on the show, we will be talking with Wendy Wolfe. She is an editor at Viking Penguin, and we'll talk about a brand new biography of Malcolm X that has just been published, titled Malcolm X, A Life of Reinvention. And then we'll give you an opportunity to ask questions about the state university retirement system here in Illinois. A lot of people, I'm sure, listening to us participate in it. I participate in it. And there are some questions about the system and how it might change in the future. So we'll have two guests, Bill Mabe, he's the executive director, and Angie Lieb, she is the director of member services. That's tomorrow. Also want to pass on a news item to you. Illinois' athletic director, Ron Gunther, has announced that he will be retiring effective June 30th after 19 years on the job. A search committee has been formed, and a new athletic director could be named mid to late summer. We'll have more on that at 12:30 in our next report of local and regional news. In this hour of Focus, our guest is Mary Lovell, and we're talking about her book, The Churchills, In Love and War, and it's a history of that family, and it's published by W.W. Norton. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, maybe we should talk, certainly hear some more about Winston. I think, you know, among the things that distinguish him was that he achieved a lot. He achieved greatness, that is certain. And like a lot of the other Churchill men, he fell in love at first sight, pretty much, with this woman named Clementine. Amazingly enough, given the history of the family, they stayed married, and they had by all accounts, had a long and very happy marriage.
Yes, I mean, it's one of the exceptions in the Churchill family that it was such a long and happy marriage. He first met her at a ball when I think he'd just come back from the Boer War, and they met at a ball, and he said to his mother, "Look at that beautiful girl." And the mother, "Please introduce us." The mother went, and this is Jenny, of course, brought her over. And Winston was, unlike Winston, he was just struck dumb. And Clementine was so embarrassed, she signaled to a friend to come and whisk her away. And, you know, they danced off, and her partner said, "Don't have anything to do with him, he's a ghastly man." Anyway, they didn't see each other for 3 years. And then Winston was invited to a dinner party, and it was given by Clementine's aunt, and he didn't want to go because he'd had a rotten day. But his secretary said, "Oh, you must, you know, lady has been so kind to you. You can't let her down at the last minute." So he turned up, and there was Clementine. Clementine had also not wanted to attend because she didn't feel she had the right clothes and she didn't have any clean white gloves. Her mother said, "You've got to go. You can't let your aunt down." So there they were. They were sat next to each other. And, well, that was it. You know, the rest is history, really. Within weeks, he had proposed to her. And he said, "Well, you know, we're not having any of this nonsense of long engagements." Within a couple of months of having, you know, agreed, I think it was 13 weeks after she accepted him, they married. Huge wedding, actually, in Westminster. A little bit like, when you look at the pictures, a little bit like the royal wedding, you know, with the streets lined with people watching them. Because, you know, he was a very important man by then. You know, he was First Lord of the Admiralty.
Mm-hmm. This, and it seems that though there were times here for Clementine that this was difficult because he was the outsized, outgoing person that we know, and she was not, certainly compared with him. And it seems that there were times when she had a very difficult time living in his world.
Yes, that's right. She was a very reserved person, I think. But, you know, the lovely thing is they were very much in love. You know, throughout their marriage, they wrote to each other every day, sometimes more than once. Even when they were in the same house, there would be a little note, you know, and they called each other pet names like kitten and puppy and, you know, this sort of thing. Throughout their lives, and very often their little drawings had a little drawing of a kitten or a puppy or a pig or whatever. And but she was a very reserved person, and she was the person who brought Winston down to earth all the time, you know, just gave him a little tug so he didn't get too far above himself. And, of course, for him, it was marvelous because she was a totally 100% rock-solid confidant. She was his rock, really. Mm-hmm. And, you know, she was always there. And if she felt he was doing something wrong, she would tell him so. And he wouldn't get annoyed with her as he would have done with someone else telling him he'd done, you know. She was just a marvelous person for him. So like Sarah had helped Duke John in his career with her contacts and in a different way, of course, Clementine was the person behind, yeah, she was definitely the person behind Churchill. Hmm. I don't think he'd have done nearly so well if it hadn't been for Clementine.
Well, he got off to a difficult start. It seems as if he didn't do well at school. He had a horrible time there. Like others of his class, I think he really didn't have very much to do with his own parents.
No, in the whole of his school life, his father, he went away to boarding school, of course. You know, he wasn't at day school and going home. He went away to boarding school. And in the whole of his school life, he saw his father twice, who visited the school. Jenny used to visit once or twice a year at school, but Randolph just twice. Once, I think, when he was about 11, Randolph came and gave a talk at the school. And then again, just before Winston left school. And every single letter from that child to his parents, and they've all been kept, are all saying, "Please come and see me, Mummy." You know, I mean, it's just awful. And his first school, he was unfortunate enough to get a sadist schoolmaster who beat the boys very badly. It wasn't just Winston. I did look into this. Winston was a naughty boy, and I just wondered if, you know, the headmaster had fixed on this one boy and thrashed him so badly. But no, there's actually quite a lot of body of evidence that this man was a sadist, and he thrashed all the boys to the extent where blood would appear. I mean, dreadful. Fortunately, Winston's nanny found the evidence of this, and she insisted that his parents move him to a different school. But he was a duffer. He never showed any of the brilliance at school that he showed in later life. Now, first of all, there was that awful headmaster that had, you know, beaten him so badly. And then, of course, he never saw anything of his parents. You know, I mean, it was a rotten childhood, in my opinion. Yeah. So it's not really surprising. It wasn't until he left school as a young man, he went into the army. He went to Sandhurst Military Academy. It wasn't until then he started educating himself. And by the time he was 21, he'd sort of turned himself out like a university graduate. You know, he was writing books that were bestsellers. He's an amazing man, really.
And that's one of the interesting things that I learned, is that he, given all that he achieved in politics, that the thing that made him most proud was the fact that he had been successful and had actually made money as a writer.
Oh, that's what he said in his old age, because he hadn't made money despite the fact that, you know, he's known as a politician. That's his sort of raison d'etre. But you didn't make money out of politics in those days. In fact, it wasn't until 1911, I think, that you even got expenses as a politician in England. But, you know, they've been making up for it ever since. But that's not how he made his money. He made all of his money with his pen, and when he was, as an old man, he said that is the thing that he's most proud of in his life, that he'd been able to keep his family and do everything that they were able to do through his pen.
Mm. He won the Nobel Prize in Literature in 1953.
He did, yes. I think that was for his book on World War II, you know, and of course, he was the right person to tell that story, wasn't he? Because he was right in the middle of the whole thing.
Yeah, we talked a little bit again about his father, Randolph. This was the man who died of syphilis,
yes.
and was thereby prevented from what seemed to be his destiny, that is, to be prime minister.
Yes.
I think that Winston, I get the impression that perhaps one reason that he went into politics was that he felt that there was something of a score to be settled on his father's account.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. He, in a way, he felt that his, you know, the Parliament had not acted very well towards his father. Don't forget, he was only 18 when his father was dying of syphilis. You know, it's terrible to lose a parent when you're young, isn't it? You know, especially one who he had looked up to so much. And in a way, I think he blamed Parliament, you know, for getting rid of his father. In fact, Parliament didn't. What happened was Randolph, very arrogantly, when he couldn't get his own way, threatened resignation if the Prime Minister wouldn't support him in a budgetary matter. And he thought that the government couldn't continue without him. Of course, many men in politics have made the same mistake. But, of course, what happened was the Prime Minister was delighted to get rid of Lord Randolph. And when asked if he would have him back at some time in the future, he said, "Did you ever hear of a man with a carbuncle on his back who wanted it back again?" So that was Lord Randolph out of politics forever, because he was too ill to get back in. And Churchill, you're quite right. Winston always wanted to get back. He wanted to take his father's place. And I think from 1924 to 1929, he held the same position, which was Chancellor of the Exchequer, same as Secretary of State for the Treasury.
Mm. We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus. Again, our guest is Mary Lovell, and we're talking about her new book, The Churchills in Love and War. It's a history of this remarkable family. W.W. Norton is the publisher. It's just out. She makes her home in Britain, but is now spending a little time in the United States to talk about the book. And we're glad that she could be here with us. And questions are welcome. Someone would like to call in, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. This is a slightly off the focus, but I'm in thinking about Winston and how he was raised, his relationship with his parents and being sent off to school like this, I cannot help but be reminded of a book that I read, actually it was near the end of last year, that it was, I thought, a really wonderful book about the royal families of Europe in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. And it concentrates pretty primarily on King George, Kaiser Wilhelm, and the Tsar. Nicholas. Right. And what's really striking is that people of now that's a completely different level than the Churchills, but that how many of them were had very little to do with their parents. They were raised by nannies and governesses, and the striking thing about it was that they continually got this message that the position into which they had been born came with tremendous responsibility, and it seemed like many of them also got this message that they were just not up to it, and they were really never going to amount to anything. It seems a remarkable thing to do to a child to say, you have this great responsibility, but you're never going to be able to do it.
No, you're quite right. When you look at it, you think, how could they expect their children to ever, you know, make good when they've had no childhood? They didn't know their parents. Their parents were almost sort of like divorced from them. They saw their parents between 4 or 5 o'clock, which was known as the children's hour. In Winston and Jack's case, and they would be sent in to visit their father, who would be in his smoking room or whatever. And an aunt wrote, you know, she had this vision of these two little pairs of round eyes peering round the screen at the father, who flapped his newspaper at them to shoo them away. You know, I mean, it's heartbreaking, isn't it? These two little boys growing up. But the fact that Winston made good is even more remarkable when you think of the upbringing that he had. Mm-hmm. But throughout this family, this Churchill family, from the time of Duke John, all of the elder sons of really had unhappy times. Quite a lot of them actually suffered from clinical depression. And it's almost as if a sort of an ancient curse has been visited on this family, because it's gone on to today, you know. I mean, the Duke of Marlborough at the moment, he's in his late 80s, but his son also has been disinherited, you know. He's very.
I've read some about Jamie, and who presumably would be the 11th Duke.
He will be the Duke. But they've disinherited him from running Blenheim, having anything to do with that trust. So presumably he'll have some kind of an allowance, and he will be the Duke. But he's not running the family firm, if you like.
And he and his father don't speak, and he's had trouble with the law, and has led a kind of wild life,
as so many of them did. Too soon, isn't it? David, that's the problem, really. But I just read yesterday, as a matter of fact, when I was coming to Philadelphia, read this article in this month's Vanity Fair about the current Duke, and it seems that the Duke's new wife, Lily Mahoney, I think her name is, has brought about a rapprochement between the Duke and Jamie is now living in a house on the estate at Blenheim, which is kind of nice, really.
Well, we'll see how that goes. We have a caller and about 5-6 minutes left. Someone here where we are, Champaign County, line 1. Hello.
I'm frankly sympathetic to your only other caller. I guess the viewership of the royal wedding wasn't as high as all the hype would have implied, and I don't really know why we're so preoccupied with royalty over here. But I was also going to ask about the war part. Your book is titled "In Love and War," so I guess the wars, or maybe those are family wars you're speaking of. But
No. Winston was pretty well known for his part in World War One and World War Two, and those are the wars that I really refer to. And of course, the first Duke, you know, with Blenheim. So
I was going to bring up the chemical weapons use that he espoused in attacking the N-words in Iraq, which I guess was sort of a generic word for anybody who was slightly dark. But I wanted to ask you, and this is still another political question, but what about his loss after the war in 45 to Clement Attlee? Did he take responsibility for that, or how was that? Was that crushing for
you? I was around in those days. You know, I'm pretty old myself, so I mean, I sort of remember the shock. You know, the people in England at that point were very naive, and when the war ended, there were literally tens of thousands. You know, they saw the pictures of the royal wedding. That's what it was like when they turned out just to see and to try to touch and be near Winston Churchill at the end of the war. He was absolutely idolized. 6 weeks later, he was voted out of office. I think, you know, people wanted a change. They just wanted a change of government. And the Labour Party, Clement Attlee's Labour Party, we don't really vote for people in England in the same way. We don't have a presidential system. We vote for a party, and we vote for the local representative, you know, our Member of Parliament. And in that case, it turned out to be Labour. But an awful lot of people were really surprised that in voting for Labour, they had voted Winston out. But, of course, he was only out of office for one term. Then he was voted back in again.
Oh, we're very short on time. I want to see if we can get one more caller. This is Champagne in line two. Hello.
Yes, hi. Small questions. I was just wondering where in relation to London is Blenheim and what happened to Winston's brother, Jack?
Right. Well, Blenheim is in Oxfordshire, and it's just about an hour and 10 minutes train ride or car ride from London. Hmm. And Jack married, again, very happily. Winston and Jack both had happy marriages, and they were this sort of exception in that family. His wife, Goonie, very beautiful, she unfortunately died young of cancer. And Jack had two children, Johnny, who was an artist, and Clarissa, who married Anthony Eden. You know, I'm sure you've heard of Anthony Eden. Very, very handsome chap. I thought he was absolutely wonderful when I was young. Anyway, I met Clarissa. She's still alive, and I interviewed her, obviously, for this book. Mm-hmm. I think she's in her 90s now. She's the Countess of Avon. So that's the answer to both those questions.
What did Jack have a profession, or was he involved?
Well, he was a stockbroker until the First World War broke out. And then, you know, it was almost like deja vu, because at the time I was doing that research and hearing about the stock market collapsing, and, you know, checks were not going to be honored, and, the only thing to have was gold. And it was almost like what was happening in today's world.
Yeah.
So many times I was finding that the things I was researching were happening again, like we've got a government which is in England at the moment, which is comprised of two parties, you know, a coalition. Mm-hmm. And people today in England think that this is something new and exciting, but actually it's all happened before. Same with stock market crashes. It's all happened before.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
All right.
Thank you for calling.
And if people do go to Britain, one can go and visit Blenheim.
Oh, absolutely. It's one of our foremost tourist attractions. And so you take a train to Oxford, and from Oxford, then you can take a bus out to Blenheim. Or I think you can probably get coach trips from London to Blenheim. But it's a wonderful day out. I mean, the grounds are wonderful. You know, when Lord Randolph married Jenny and he took her to Blenheim for the first time, they leaned out of the coach and he said to her, "This is the finest view in England." And, you know, I think he might be right. It is wonderful.
Yeah. And Winston, apparently, unlike some of the other Churchills, actually loved the place and did get a chance to spend time there with because he was close to his cousin,
he was close
Sonny.
To Sonny, and he was also very, very good friends with Consuelo throughout their lives. I think they met shortly before they both died in New York when he was visiting New York in his 80s. And Consuelo lived about another year, and I think Winston lived another 2 years. But during all that time, he was always welcome there. I think, you know, it meant more to him because he couldn't have it. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
He would have loved to have been a duke because he had that sort of grandiose ideas about himself. But in a way, it meant more to him because he couldn't have it, really. But it always, I think, throughout his life, it defined him. You know, he was born at Blenheim. He was a grandson of a duke, and it defined him. He was never an arrogant. He wasn't arrogant in the way that, you know, a lot of his relatives were. But he knew where he was. He knew his place, and he knew his value, and he knew his worth.
Mm.
And it was Blenheim that was, behind that, I think.
Can you just give us about a minute on his children? It seems like, again, they were not particularly happy or successful.
He didn't have. His children were not successful, with the exception of his youngest daughter, Mary, who had a very happy life and is a successful author. There was his son, Randolph, who was absolutely a disaster, really. He thought he'd inherited his father's ability and was going to be prime minister. Of course, nothing of the sort. He married Pamela Digby, who became Pamela Harriman, who probably known to quite a lot of your listeners. That was a disaster. He then married again. And eventually, just at the end of his life, he made good. He started writing the authorized book of his father's life. Then there was Diana, who married a top politician. That was that marriage ended in scandalous divorce, which we haven't time to go into. The next daughter, Sarah, she went onto the stage. She married Vic Oliver. She appeared in a movie called Royal Wedding, which is a bit topical. She had three marriages. I mean, and the other child, little Marigold, died tragically of a fever when she was only a few months, I think 3 years old. So none of, with the exception of Mary, Winston and Clementine's children did not have happy lives, really.
Well, we're going to have to leave it at that with the recommendation that if you're interested in reading some more of this very entertaining story, this family history, not a, really a political history, but a family history of this remarkable family occupying some 300 years of British history. The book to look for is The Churchills in Love and War by our guest Mary Lovell. It's published by W.W. Norton. She makes her home in England, but she's now spending some time in the United States, traveling around talking about the book. And Ms. Lovell, thank you very much.
Thank you, David.